do. We would run circles around all our former doing the right thing stuff. You know, if you really look into your face of the face of your neighbor, whoever he or she happens to be, and you allow yourself to be seduced by their pain, and I mean that, seduced by their pain, drawn in by it, and do not, you aren't worrying about whether this is the proper thing or the right thing or the legal thing or the Christian thing, but allow yourself just to be totally sucked in, and you are not distracted by how you should be doing it, you will be amazed at what you will do. And I think that's the power of the gospel. That is the power. The law still stands. The law still stands. And the law was given to provide freedom. The Old Testament talks about it glowingly. But the law cannot do it. It falls far too short. It cannot do it. But it is the gospel. If we really trust, if we take seriously these words that I underline, we are to repent of our love of slavery, repent of the fear of speaking words of power to power. In the face of the law, we all crumple, and we don't rely on the words of the gospel. Repenting of slavish adherence to tradition, repenting of all that satisfies one for the moment, but forges change for others to come. The obligation of the gospel is that you be free, and that you live that way, and that you really lean heavy on the gospel. Somebody reminded me yesterday that Augustine says, love God and do what pleases you. That sounds awful to us. But if we really took God at his word and trusted the gospel, that God will declare what our good works are. Really trust God to do that. We don't need to worry about whether we're doing the right thing or not. Just love your neighbor. Just focus in on that. I think that's where the power is, and perhaps I haven't said it, and perhaps I needed a bit of a crisis to draw that out. The other thing is that don't let anyone try to tell you that whatever your pain or your suffering is, that it's too trivial, or that there's something more important. Resist that. And don't you say to anybody else that their concern is too trivial. It may be trivial, but you don't bring healing to it by just walking away from it, saying it's too trivial to deal with. It may be really big and important for you, and so it does need to be looked at. The gospel is big enough for big and little issues, and they are all connected. They really are. Let the gospel heal even the little stuff, and that will enable you to do bigger things, if that is a concern. Well, anyhow, I had to say that all. Quick comment, a rebuttal or anything from that? Okay. We'll get on with Ruth, the book of. I'm working with the RSV. If you want to work with something else, that's fine. I'd like to push this book. Most of what I do with Ruth, or a lot of the ideas I got from this book, called God and the Rhetoric of Sexuality by Phyllis Tribble. She's an exegete, a rhetorical critic, and so she does a lot with word order and parallelism and all sort, you know, A prime, B, B prime, that kind of stuff, more than what I talk about. This was published in 1978 by Fortress. It's in the bookstore. This was $6.50, it may be a little higher. I've had this number of years already. But she does other things too. She talks about creation, metaphors for God, Song of Songs. So you might find it a helpful book. Okay, Book of Ruth, chapter 1, verse 1. In the days when the judges ruled, before the kings, this is some time ago, there was a famine in the land, and a certain man, it's hot when I get head up, a certain man of Bethlehem. Bethlehem means house of bread. That will be more important as the story unravels. Bethlehem and Judah went to sojourn in the country of Moab, a foreign land, he and his wife and his two sons. The name of the man was Elimelech, and the name of his wife was Naomi, and the names of his two sons were Mahlon and Chilion. Elimelech, the name means, my God is king. Naomi means sweet one. Mahlon means sickness, and Chilion means pining away. Names had power then, more than what we allot for now. They were Ephrathites from Bethlehem and Judah. They went into the country of Moab and remained there. But Elimelech, the husband of Naomi, died, and she was left with her two sons. These took Moabite wives, The name of the one was Orpah, which means she who turns away. And the name of the other was Ruth, which means the beloved. They lived there about 10 years, and both Mahlon and Chilion died. No children in those 10 years, which was death for families, in a sense. So that the woman was bereft of her two sons and her husband. Look what happens. This Naomi loses her name. She is called the woman by the end of the chapter. She has lost her sons, and in a patriarchal society, she's lost her identity. Women had identity by being connected to men. She loses it here. Not only is she just the woman, but she is used in connection with passive verbs. She was bereft. She's not the subject of active verbs by their death. The narrator kind of doubled in his language what is happening in the story. Verse 6, then she started with her daughters-in-law to return to the country from the country of Moab. Naomi now is subject of active verbs. She takes charge and she's going to begin the return. For she had heard in the country, she, however, is not yet named. She's not yet named, but she is subject of active verbs. She had heard in the country of Moab that the Lord had visited his people and given them food. So she set out from the place where she was with her two daughters-in-law, and they went on their way to return to the land of Judah. But Naomi, she is named, she begins to speak, said to her two daughters-in-law, go, return each of you to her mother's house. Now that's real interesting in the patriarchal culture. You didn't return to your mother's home. You returned to your father's home. It was his home, and they didn't talk about returning to your mother's home. But this is a story of women, and perhaps from her perspective, they were returning to their mother's home. May the Lord deal kindly with you as you have dealt with the dead and with me. The Lord grant that you may find a home, each of you, in the house of her husband. What's behind that word, deal kindly, is the Hebrew word chesed, which is on the board, variously written that way. Nice guttural. That's it. Our two-year-old does that a lot. I think we ought to teach him German or Hebrew now. He gets those gutturals down. Chesed is always a term of relationship. It's sometimes translated to show mercy, steadfast love, to love kindness, a variety of translations. But it was a word, a term of relationship. And it was always shown from a superior to a social inferior. When Jonathan and David made this covenant between them, they were two friends, they promised to show chesed to one another. When Jonathan was the king's son and in a position of power, and David was being harassed by Saul, it was Jonathan who showed chesed to David by hiding him, spiriting him away, whatever needed to be done to preserve his life. When the tables were reversed and David became king, Jonathan, Saul's family, was not too well liked at that point. David continued to show chesed, even after Jonathan died, to Jonathan's descendants. It's always from social superior to inferior, and it's a commitment. It's always a relationship term. You don't just show chesed to all the people of India. You know, it's in a relationship. I don't have a relationship with people of India, but I do with some of you and the people in which I live. It is not noblesse oblige. You don't do it because it's your duty. You know, we are the wealthy, therefore we send tax-deductible charity checks to whatever group that needs it. That's not chesed. It is spontaneous and it's an act of grace. It's not something you do because you have to. The person in the superior position never has to show kindness to the inferior one, even if that person has no other recourse. You don't have to do it. You're free to do it. And of course, the prime example of that is Yahweh, God, who shows chesed to his people. However, in this passage, as we will find out just a little bit later when Naomi talks to the women, she is very harsh. She says, Yahweh has dealt bitterly with me. He hasn't shown me any chesed. But she invokes Yahweh's chesed on her daughters-in-law, and the model she uses for Yahweh to follow is the daughter-in-laws themselves. As you have dealt kindly with the dead and with me. These foreign women are to be the model on which Yahweh is to show chesed on them in the future. The Lord grant that you may find a home, each of you, in the house of her husband. That was life for women in the patriarchal culture. Then she kissed them, and they lifted up their voices and wept. And they said to her, "No, we will go with you, return with you to your people." But Naomi said, "Turn back, my daughters. Why will you go with me? Have I yet sons in my womb that they may become your husbands? Turn back, my daughters, go your way, for I am too old to have a husband. If I should say I have hope, even if I should have a husband this night and should bear sons, would you therefore wait till they were grown? Would you therefore refrain from marrying?" This long expanded thing about whether Naomi can have children or not, it shows the focus of where life is. The life is in having a husband. And Naomi almost exhausts herself in telling us that she can't give that to them. To choose going with her is to choose death for them, at least culturally. "No, my daughters," let's see, I'm verse 13, "my daughters, it is exceedingly bitter to me for your sake that the hand of the Lord has gone forth against me. He has not shown chesed to me. His hand has gone forth against me." 14, "Then they lifted up their voices and wept again, and Orpah kissed her mother-in-law, but Ruth clung to her. And she said, Naomi to Ruth, "See, your sister-in-law has gone back to her people and to her gods. Return after your sister-in-law." But Ruth said, "Entreat me not to leave you or to return from following you. For where you go, I will go. Where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there will I be buried. May the Lord do so to me, and more also, if even death parts me from you." This is, I don't know if it still is, but in the past has been used in marriage ceremonies to kind of indicate the wife's willingness to do whatever her husband does, to go along with it. And if that was part of your wedding ceremony and you cherish that, don't feel bad about what I'm going to say. You, however, probably did not call down an oath upon you. "May the Lord do so to me, and more also, if even death parts me from you." She calls upon death down upon herself if she doesn't follow through. These are words of a woman to a woman, and they are not words of acquiescence. Orpah is the one who is in line with Naomi's wishes. She goes back. She dies to the story by being in line with what Naomi wants, but Ruth is refusing. These are words of refusal. They are not words of submission. She is choosing something that is illogical, impractical, stupid, and implies death for her. Her hopes for cultural survival were in her own land, not by going off to a foreign land with a woman who is so shredded and practically going home to die like the elephants do. She is refusing. She is committing herself to Naomi. It's a very radical step she's taking. Tribble says in her book that Ruth's leap of faith here even outstrips Abraham's because Abraham had a call from God. Ruth didn't even have that. That may be true. I hesitate to say whose leap of faith is bigger, greater, longer than the other one's leap of faith. I don't know if we could know that. But certainly I think the comparison is apt, that the radical step that Ruth has taken to leave her home and go to a foreign land, as Abraham did, radical, and it's scary, and it's, well, gosh, I mean, you know, you got to be a little bit out of your mind to do it. And when Naomi saw that she was determined to go with her, she said no more. Almost forgets about her, as we shall see in the next couple verses. So the two of them went on until they came to Bethlehem, house of bread. And when they came to Bethlehem, the whole town was stirred because of them. And the woman said, "Is this Naomi?" I wonder if she was so changed that they couldn't believe it. She was gone, well, at least 10 years. We don't know. "Is this Naomi?" They probably never expected to see her again, like coming back from the dead. And that's what she feels like. She said to them, "Don't call me Naomi, sweet one. Call me Mara." That means bitter. "For the Almighty has dealt very bitterly with me." Again, no chesed from him. "I went away full with sons and husband in pursuit of food to a foreign land, and the Lord has brought me back empty. Why do you call me Naomi when the Lord has afflicted me and the Almighty has brought calamity upon me?" But then the narrator does what Naomi can't do, at least at that point. So Naomi returned, and Ruth the Moabite is her daughter-in-law with her. Naomi says she returns empty. The narrator says, oh, not quite empty. You have the possibility of life who's come trotting along behind you. You are so angry and so hurt that you can't see it. But the narrator reminds us, one, that Ruth is with her, the possibility of life, and they came to Bethlehem at the beginning of barley harvest. There is possibility of life in this woman who is so filled with death. Chapter 2. Now Naomi had a kinsman of her husband, a man of wealth of the family of Elimelech, whose name was Boaz. Holds the name to the end, kind of holds off our suspense. Chapter 1 begins with three males, all of whom died to the story. But now we find out that there's a little hope. There's this rich, fat cat kinsman of theirs, Boaz. Little bit of hope. And Ruth the Moabite said to Naomi, Ruth takes charge in this chapter. She is the one who takes responsibility for providing food for them. Ruth says, let me go to the field and glean among the ears of grain after him in whose sight I shall find favor. And Naomi says, go. She can acquiesce, but she has no energy for doing any of the engineering at this point. So she sets forth and went and gleaned in the field after the reapers, and she happened to come in the part of the field belonging to Boaz, just by chance, who was of the family of Elimelech. By chance, or happened to come, kind of code word for the divine guidance in the book of Ruth. Boaz is a man of power, and the women are doing a lot of the engineering in this story, but there's some divine blessing going on too. Just by chance, she happened to get to this field. And behold, Boaz came out to see how the folks were getting along, comes out from Bethlehem, and he said to the reapers, the Lord be with you. And they answered, and also with you. Then Boaz said to his servant who was in charge of the reapers, whose maiden is this? Typically patriarchal question. Not what's her name, but to whom does she belong? And Ruth does not fit the culture. She doesn't belong to anybody. So she doesn't have anybody who, well, I mean, it was a sad thing, too. I mean, it wasn't just that she was a tough, gutsy, independent raw burner. She didn't have anyone. And so the servant cannot answer whose maiden she is. He has to say, the Moabite maiden who came back with Naomi from the country of Moab. A derivative identity. He doesn't know her name. He doesn't respond with her name. She's a foreigner. She came back with Naomi, kind of trudging along like the little kitty cat. And she asked, pray let me glean and gather among the sheaves after the reapers. So she came and has continued from early morning until now without resting even for a moment, diligent in her attempts to provide food for her little family, such as it is. Then Boaz said to Ruth, now listen, my daughter, do not go to glean in another field or leave this one, but keep close to my maidens. Let your eyes be upon the field which they are reaping and go after them. In other words, don't get so concerned with looking down that they go off and you're stranded and perhaps then are left prey. But keep close eye on them and stick by. Have I not charged the young man not to molest you? He's protecting her. And when you are thirsty, go to the refrigerator and get yourself a beer. And as she falls on her face, bowing to the ground, and says to him, typical oriental obeisance, way down to the ground, why have I found favor in your eyes that I should take notice of me when I'm a foreigner? Foreigner and just a strange woman, unattached woman. But Boaz answers her, all that you have done for your mother-in-law since the death of your husband has been fully told to me. Yeah, he knew about it. He knew everything that had happened to them. He hasn't lifted a finger to help. Why, we don't know. How you left your father, mother, and your native land and came to a people that you did not know before. The Lord recompense you for what you have done, and a full reward be given you by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge. He is in here asking God's blessing upon her. And we'll see later how he gets involved in being a part of that blessing. He is in this particular place in line with the solid tradition of Israel that cared for the sojourner. The three groups that they were always to care for, the sojourner, the widow, and the orphan. They were the most vulnerable and defenseless in that society. And they were to care for them because you too have been sojourners. He is behaving in the best of that tradition, protecting the sojourner. She said, you are most gracious to me, my Lord, for you have comforted me and spoken kindly to your maidservant, though I am not one of your maidservants. And at mealtime, he invites her to come over and sit down, eat some bread, dip your morsel in the wine. She sits with the reapers, and she saves what's left over to take home to Naomi. I'm going to hurry a little bit. And Boaz even says, not only let her glean unmolested, but pull out a few of the sheaves for her, so it's not so hard. She gleaned in the field until evening. She goes home. She takes what she had gleaned and also what she had saved from lunch and gives it to her Naomi. And Naomi thinks, oh, well, maybe things aren't going to be quite as bad as I thought. And her mother-in-law perks up, where did you glean today and where have you worked? Blessed be the man who took notice of you. And she tells him that it was Boaz. And Naomi said, oh my goodness, he's a near kinsman of ours. Holy cow, we didn't even know about it. Blessed be the Lord, whose kindness has not forsaken the living or the dead. Yahweh, after all, has shown chesed to her. He has not, one chapter away, there wasn't anything, and now she can see it. Naomi also said to her, the man is a relative of ours, one of our nearest kin. So she's not so forsaken after all. And Ruth the Moabitess said, besides, he said to me, you shall keep close by my maidservants till they have finished all my harvest. And so Naomi says, just stick there until the barley harvest is over. And she does. She lived with her mother-in-law. Chapter 3, Naomi is encouraged. She takes charge in this chapter, and she provides for their cultural life. Then Naomi, her mother-in-law, said to her, my daughter, should I not seek a home for you that it may be well with you? That mirrors the concern that she said in chapter 1. Can I have any more sons? I'm deaf to you if I can't provide you with a husband. So in chapter 3, she begins to go about doing that. Now is not Boaz our kinsman with whose maidens you were? See, he is winnowing barley tonight at the threshing floor, a time of great celebration and hilarity. Wash, therefore, and anoint yourself, and put on your best clothes, and go down to the threshing floor. But do not make yourself known to the man until he has finished eating and drinking. But when he lies down, observe the place where he lies, then go and uncover his feet and lie down, and he will tell you what to do. And Ruth, this time, is acquiescing. She says, gotcha. Goes on. You got it, Mom, as my three-year-old says. You got it, Mom. Verse 6, she goes down to the threshing floor and did just as her mother-in-law told her. And when Boaz had eaten and drunk and his heart was merry, he went to lie down at the end of a heap of grain. By chance, again, a little separate from the others, at the end of a heap of grain, not in the middle of where everybody else was. Then she comes softly and uncovers his feet and lay down. Now, there are various interpretations what is meant, understood by feet here, whether it was just literally his feet or she uncovered more of him. There is definitely, though, a sexual implication here, as is revealed a little bit later on here. At midnight, the man was startled and turned over. No doubt he's getting cold. And behold, a woman lay at his feet, and he said, who are you? Not to whom do you belong, but now who are you? What is your identity? And she answered, I am Ruth, your maidservant. Spread your skirt over your maidservants, for you are next of kin. This is a blatant proposal of marriage. You're next of kin. You have the obligation to marry me and to raise up a son to my dead husband. The levirate law of Israel, but not of Moab, was that if a man died leaving no children, specifically no sons, sometimes provisions were made for daughters to inherit. There were no sons. The next of kin, often the next brother, was to marry the wife, even if he already had one, marry the widow. And the first son that the widow would bear would then be considered the progeny of the dead husband, so that his name would live on and his inheritance could be passed on. So she's saying, and that person was often called the Redeemer. Boaz is being called upon to be the Redeemer. And he said, may you be blessed by the Lord, my daughter. You have made this last kindness, chesed, greater than the first, and to Naomi, in that you have not gone after young men, he's an old geezer, whether rich or poor. And now, my daughter, do not fear. I will do for you all that you ask. You remember in chapter 2, he called the blessing of the Lord upon her. The Lord recompensed you for what you have done. We have to be careful what we pray for. God may ask us to be the instrument of blessing to other people. Boaz very, very, I don't know if it's naively, but he asked a blessing upon her. And now she is calling him to an obligation. Okay, you be that blessing to me now. He says, okay, gotcha. However, verse 12, and now it is true that I am a near kinsman, Yet there is a kinsman nearer than I. Remain this night, and in the, again, we had no notion that Naomi had anybody, living relatives. Remain this night, and in the morning, if he will do the part of the next of kin for you, well, let him do it. But if he is not willing to do the part of the next of kin, to do the part of Redeemer, then as the Lord lives, I will do the part of the next of kin for you. Lie down until morning. So she lay at his feet until the morning, but arose before one could recognize another, while it's still dark. And he said, let it not be known that the woman came to the threshing floor. He wants to protect her reputation in the community. He has said in verse 11, all my fellow townsmen know that you are a woman of worth, and he wants to maintain that for her sake. But also, he is distancing the intimacy that this little encounter had. She is now not Ruth. She is the woman. The intimacy is gone. But yet, he asked her to bring her mantle and hold it out, and he measures 6 measures of barley. Kind of a seal, in a sense, upon his promise to do what he can to give her cultural life. He gives her 6 measures of barley. That's kind of... I'll sure try to do as best as I can, and here's kind of a proof of my intentions. And she goes back to the city. And when she came to her mother-in-law, she said, how did you fare, my daughter? Then she told her all that the man had done for her, saying, these 6 measures of barley he gave me, for he said, you must not go back empty-handed to your mother-in-law. Well, we don't know that he said that, but perhaps he did. She doesn't. What she tells him, all that the man had done for her. It had not happened as Naomi said it would. Naomi says, get togged out, go lie down, and then he'll tell you what to do. Boaz doesn't. Ruth takes charge. She tells him what he's supposed to do. You are to be the redeemer in my situation. You are to do the part of the next of kin. If Ruth tells her that, we don't know of it. She just tells of the gift of grain. Naomi, satisfied, she replied, wait, my daughter, until you learn how the matter turns out, for the man will not rest, but will settle the matter today. Chapter 4, scene 4. So Boaz goes up to the gate and sits down there, and behold, the next of kin of whom Boaz had spoken comes by. In the city gate were decided all sorts of disputes and whatever local decisions and wranglings were going on. It kind of reminds me of... In North Dakota, South Dakota, and stuff, there are a lot of little truck stops and so forth. And very often, once I was traveling through and had breakfast there, and I noticed the droves of men that come in and sometimes have breakfast and then go home and eat their wives' breakfast too, but all of them invariably sat and drank coffee. And I kind of perceived that as their support group. I don't know what they talked about or if they made heavy-weighted community decisions there or not, but that's kind of my modern-day picture of what happened here. All the men gathered at one place, and they were there gathered in case any dispute came up. And then those there assembled were the judges. So he gets the next of kin. He takes 10 men of the elders of the city, a quorum, and they had to be the respected older ones. And he tells them to sit down. I got something really heavy to tell you here. So they sit down, and he says to the next of kin, the he is Boaz. Naomi, who has come back from the country of Moab, is selling a parcel of land. This destitute widow turns out to be landed gentry. We didn't know she had land to sell. All of a sudden, she's got land to sell, a parcel of land which belonged to our kinsman Elimelech. So I thought, you know, I'd tell you about it just in case you're interested in buying it. Buy it in the presence of those sitting here and in the presence of the elders of my people. If you will redeem it, redeem it. But if you will not, tell me, that I may know, for there is no one besides you to redeem it, and I come after you. And the guy says, oh, I'll redeem it, sure, sure. Then Boaz says, the day you buy the field from the hand of Naomi, you are also buying Ruth the Moabitess, the widow of the dead, in order to restore the name of the dead to his inheritance. Buying Ruth, I mean, that's how it was thought of. She is property to be bought. She comes along with a parcel of land. And the point of all this is to restore the name of the dead to his inheritance. That's Boaz's commentary on why this is all happening in front of the elders. And now here we see the motivation of this next of kin. He says, oh, I can't do it, or I will impair my own inheritance, take my right of redemption, for I cannot redeem it. This guy shows himself up to be selfish. If he was just going to be acquiring land, that was fine. But getting another wife was somehow going to screw up his inheritance. Exactly how, I don't know. While that was the law, the Levirate law, to do this kind of redeeming, it didn't always happen. In the story, Genesis 38, some of you, most of you probably weren't here last week. Read that sometime. It's a marvelous story. Several men in there refused to do the Levirate law, and they were punished for that. But the men did not always willingly go along with this. And this guy, too. If it involves messing up his own inheritance, he's not going to do that kindness to his dead kinsman Elimelech. And so we have a description here, a custom that probably was outdated at the time this was written. Otherwise, he would, in such a short book, they wouldn't explain it. You draw off your shoe, sandal, and hand it to the other one. This was the custom concerning redeeming and exchanging to confirm a transaction. The one drew off his sandal and gave it to the other, and this was the manner of attesting in Israel. So the next of kin says to Boaz, buy it for yourself. He draws off his sandal, and Boaz said to the elders and all the people, you are witnesses this day that I have bought from the hand of Naomi all that belonged to Elimelech and all that belonged to Chilion and to Mahlon. These old buzzards finally are resurrected to the story. They died to the story. It's been a women's story. Now that the land has been redeemed, Ruth has been redeemed, bought, now they come to life. There's a potential for their name living on, finally, and so they are renamed. You notice, however, we never know the name of the next of kin. The point was, he didn't want to buy Ruth so that his inheritance wouldn't get mixed up, so that he wouldn't lose his name to posterity. The judgment upon his selfish conduct is that he is unnamed. He does die. He, in fact, loses his life in trying to save it, to kind of shove forward to the gospel. Verse 10, also Ruth the Moabitess, the widow of Mahlon, I have bought to be my wife, to perpetuate the name of the dead in his inheritance, that the name of the dead may not be cut off from among his brethren and from the gate of his native place. You are witnesses. And they say, we are witnesses. May the Lord, now they pronounce a blessing, may the Lord make the woman, doesn't matter what her name is, who is coming to your house like Rachel and Leah, may the Lord make the woman who is coming to your house like Rachel and Leah, who together build up the house of Israel. May you prosper in Ephrathah and be renowned in Bethlehem. And may your house be like the house of Perez, whom Tamar bore to Judah, because of the children that the Lord will give you by this young woman. There's an interesting story in Genesis 38 between Perez and Tamar. She seduces her father-in-law, commits incest with him in order to be faithful to her dead husband, to fulfill the Levirate law. The details of the story are very rarely dragged out. I think they're only in Genesis 8. But here, of all the women in Israel that could have been picked on, it's Tamar, the woman who played the harlot, who is named here. And may your house be like her sons, Perez. She had twins, as it turns out, but Perez was the firstborn. 13, so Boaz took Ruth, and she became his wife. Oh, boy. And he went into her, and the Lord gave her conception, and she bore a son. Boaz has a lot of power in the story. He's a powerful man. Ruth and Naomi engineer events. But neither life does not reside either in the males or the females. It's God who gives conception. God gives life. She bears a son. 10 years of childlessness in Moab, and here she bears a son finally. Then the woman said to Naomi, blessed be the Lord. The women of the city who greeted Naomi when she came in, and she said, why do you call me Naomi? The Lord has made it bitter for me. The women to Naomi, blessed be the Lord who has not left you this day without next of kin. Naomi says, I have come back empty. And they say, oh no, you have next of kin. And may his name be renowned in Israel. That is the child born. He shall be to you a restorer of life and a nourisher of your old age. When the men were talking in the city gate, the point of this whole marriage was that the dead have let their inheritance live on. The women say, this child is for you. He restores life to the living, not a name to the dead. Both are true, but different perspectives. And then something so remarkable. For your daughter-in-law who loves you, who is more to you than 7 sons has borne him. A daughter never was valued to a son, never had value to a son in that culture. But this daughter-in-law who loves you is more to you than seven sons. That is high praise. High praise indeed for that culture, to be said of a woman, and even she, a foreigner. Then Naomi took the child and laid him in her bosom and became his nurse. And the women of the neighborhood gave him a name. The women name here. Usually it was the father. The women do the naming. A son has been born to Naomi, not to Elimelech or to Mahlon, but to Naomi. They named him Obed. He was the father of Jesse, the father of David. And then we get the, in 18 to 22, the generations there. Ruth is mentioned in Matthew's genealogy of Christ. There are five women mentioned in chapter 1 of Matthew. One is Mary, mother of Jesus. Another one is Rahab the harlot, who gave hid the spies when they were on their journey. Another one is Bathsheba, who committed adultery with King David. Another one is Tamar, who a foreign woman who seduced her father-in-law and played the harlot. And the other one is Ruth the Moabitess, the foreigner. All outsiders of the tradition are ones who are held up in the Gospel of Matthew as women of faith, the women who reckon to be counted among the mothers of Israel. So I've gone farther than I like, longer than I like to. Aren't you?
Perhaps on the inheritance question, both the next generation inherited Naomi's estate on her death, but Naomi had no grandchildren or sons to pass it on to, so therefore, he would redeem Ruth and raised up a son, and then all Naomi's estate was under that son.
That's right.
His nephew added that to his son.
That's right. That's right.
How it would have screwed up his estate.
Yeah, you're right.
And he knew that by redeeming the land, he could get the land and his money eventually.
That's right. That's right.
The land now is over.
That's right. That's right. That is the connection, I bet. I saw him.
I wasn't the hand.
Okay, we'll go.
Boaz, the son, though, seems not to be reckoned so much a son of, I don't know, would have been Mahlon or the brother, but of Boaz and Ruth. I mean, later identity is through Boaz, so that's a strange turn of events.
Yeah. Well, and it depends on the perspective, too. I mean, when Boaz is doing it in the gates, it's all for the point of the levirate law. And the women are commenting, see it as a sign of life for Naomi. She who had this earlier conversation with them and came back empty and bitter and lifeless. And they say, well, it's turned around now, they say to her. You know, the son has been born to you.
Isn't Sam saying that it should have been son of Kilian or whatever one of the brothers she was married to? Not Boaz. Boaz became the husband, and therefore it raises the name of Naomi's son.
Is that what you mean?
Yeah.
At the very end there. Oh, okay.
Reminds me of the other one. It says that the son is born to Naomi. Well, the son was born to Ruth.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So there are. It's not. I don't think it's critical, but it's interesting.
Yeah. Wording and word order are interesting. They often reveal other things. One woman mentioned that earlier too. She said, "If I had a son, I wouldn't want it to be said that it was my mother-in-law." Well, it says that she becomes his nurse. I doubt if she was the wet nurse. She
took care of it, I think, like a nanny or whatever.
Yeah. I think the women say a son has been born to you because they are the ones, the only time they showed up earlier in the story is when they're having that conversation with Naomi. They're all gathered at the well, and here she comes trudging in, looks like death warmed over. They can't believe, my, hasn't she changed? Look at her hair. Gosh, hasn't she heard about, you know, probably some of the catty stuff that goes on. And then she has that conversation with them. They don't appear until later than in the story. And so they say, see how it's turned out? You've got a son after all. You didn't come back empty. I kind of see it in that context because their conversation is exclusively with her throughout the story. And so then they view it from their perspective and her perspective rather than from the males in the story.
Ruth?
Mm-hmm.
The fact that Ruth was a Moabitess.
See your beard?
Yeah.
she's a foreigner.
Yeah.
But wasn't Moab the result of an incestuous relationship?
Oh, yeah. Noah, right? Noah's daughters?
Was it Lot, I think?
Oh, Lot's daughters who slept with him.
Yeah.
Yeah, and one of those children was Moab, yeah.
Was that part of the reason why the Moabites were an abomination? Not just because they were foreigners, but because their origin was one of sexual irregularity.
They kept it the same, well.
Go ahead.
The same is true of Tamar and Judah. I think that was more kind of I think we used the word now, I will anyway. They were related, except that I think that the Jewish people kind of would have said of the Moabites, you bastard.
Yeah.
No, right?
Yeah.
And I think it's peculiar how many times she referred to it as a Moabite.
Yeah.
Over and over and over.
Yeah.
And then it also would fit with the genealogy that all the women would have sexual irregularity in their background. Mm-hmm. In the Matthean genealogy.
Oh, if you see Moab, Ruth in the tradition of her
she's
people.
She's the exception, isn't she?
Yes.
Huh.
Mm-hmm. Of those four women, she is the exception.
Yeah.
But yeah, if you take her national roots, she fits in with that too. I haven't seen that. Yeah, that's right.
John A.T. Robinson, in his book, The Human Face of God, says that what that tells us is that the conception of Jesus was a sexual irregularity as well.
With Mary.
It wasn't a virginal conception. The story in Matthew and Luke are quite different on that. Mm-hmm. The angel comes to Joseph and says, don't divorce Mary. You have every reason to. She got pregnant with someone else. Mm-hmm. And then the child is born from a sexual irregular conception with another man,
mm-hmm.
but God will send that child to be holy anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Just as this whole lineage just showed you out of sexual irregularity.
Very good.
So the miracle
is
a moral miracle and not a biological one. But in Luke, it is a biological miracle.
Uh-huh.
There it's quite clear it's virginal conception. Uh-huh. But in Matthew, there's not fear.
Yeah. That's good. Yeah, I hadn't seen that. Did I put you to sleep with my long monologue?
Explain what Ron said again.
Well, I want Ron should explain it.
The immorally lineage?
According to Matthew, let me see if I say it right. According to Matthew, in Matthew, the angel comes to Joseph in the dream, or God comes to him in the dream, however it's worded, not to divorce Mary. She has become pregnant by someone else. Even so, despite that, the child shall be holy. And so Mary, the fifth woman named in that genealogy, is in line with the other four women who had sexual irregularities in their background, Ruth included, if you include her nationality. And so the miracle in Matthew is not biological of a virginal conception, but is a moral miracle. Is that right? Did I say that right? Who was that guy, Robinson?
Yeah, John A.T. Robinson.
I hadn't heard of that. But in Luke, it's a biological miracle. Those are the only two Gospels that even talk about John and Mark don't even talk about them. So they. The question is, has Robinson ever read Matthew 1:18, where it says that she was found to be a child with the Holy Spirit? Where does he get off that it's not a did he address that it was not a
That's the key text for him.
Okay.
To say that the child is of the Holy Spirit means that the child has been adopted of the Holy Spirit.
Hmm.
What does it mean to be of? What's the genitive there? So he does work the text through. You disagree, of course, with the way he does it.
Yeah.
He pays attention to it.
Could you hear that?
Yeah.
Okay. Y'all might, if you're interested.
The name of the book is The Human Face of God. That's the argument.
The Human Face of God, in case you're interested in pursuing that.
Matthew's a little different.
Yeah.
One of the interesting things for me in this Ruth story, you alluded to when you were talking about the difference between Abraham's call,
yeah,
and the call of God, and here it almost is by chance, and yet God works, seems to work through just random chance. And I thought that, at least my own experience, has been much closer to this random chance and God working through that than through the voice in the night, you know, the goal.
Yeah.
When you think about your own life, how many of you the college you choose to go to or the person you marry just hinge on a chance phone call or someone who drops in and introduces you to something?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Some of it all depends on whether you have eyes to see or not. You know? Yeah. You're open to seeing it.
Is that Tribble's interpretation of it? Because it would seem to me like a call is a very difficult word for me to cope with. For me, it's always easy to say, see in retrospect, that was a call.
Is what her interpretation of what?
That Ruth, that Abraham went by a call.
He has an explicit call. I think that's her wording.
Yeah. In any story form, I wonder if that isn't always a judgment made in retrospect rather than it is, I have been called to go there and then do it in the future tense. I don't know, but I'm wondering. Do you understand what I'm saying?
No.
That you do it and then looking back on it, it was a call.
Yeah.
Oh, that
it's often
maybe
hard.
She had a call that was similar to his. Is that
yeah.
what you're saying? That
yeah,
there are words given to his. And not to hers?
Yeah, that somebody in the story said for him, this is
oh, he
call.
Had a call, okay.
Now,
whether
I'm
he in fact heard voices or not,
yeah.
is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
I don't, she will, she pretty clearly will just take the text and whatever the words are, she goes with them pretty much. I can read you what she says about that. From a cultural perspective, Ruth has chosen death over life. She has disavowed the solidarity of family, she has abandoned national identity, and she has renounced religious affiliation. In the entire epic of Israel, only Abraham matches this radicality, but then he had a call from God, Genesis 12, 1-5. Divine promise motivated and sustained his leap of faith. Besides, Abraham was a man with a wife and other possessions to accompany him. Ruth stands alone. She possesses nothing. No God has called her, no deity has promised her blessing, no human being has come to her aid. She lives and chooses without a support group, and she knows that the fruit of her decision may well be the emptiness of rejection, indeed of death. Consequently, not even Abraham's leap of faith surpasses this decision of Ruth. So, but like I say, I don't know who's to judge leaps.
But other people have probably done that and just forgotten.
Sure.
She has to do that. Ruth, because of her lineage. Right,
yeah.
That she's remembered.
Yeah. Well, I think some of us do that. And we don't dare call it a leap of faith or don't think we had a call like Abraham.
What's
you know?
Boaz mean?
What is his? Oh, you know, I don't know. Does anybody know what Boaz means? Do you have any footnotes? I don't know.
Sugar daddy.
He's the real sweet one in the story, huh? Not Naomi. You never thought of him as old?
Not that old.
Well, I don't know how that old is. I mean, we like to romanticize the story, and if Hollywood got a hold of it, oh, it would be just drippy, you know. I mean, chapter 3 would be, oh, you know what they do with that in this day and age?
They'd give it to Lafayette. But he was an old man because he said so.
Well, he says, you have not gone after young men, implication being he's not one of them. He's also fairly respected in the community. He's in charge. His father is dead because he is in charge of the lands. He has a lot. She probably was early
20s. That's what I was going to say. She's not exactly young in that culture either.
No.
She had been married.
Probably when she was 12 or 13.
So
she was married 10 years. She's early 20s probably by the time in this. So even if he's 35, he's got one foot in the grave by that culture.
Yeah.
You know, because they didn't live real long. So by comparison, it's not as though it's the marriage between two 12-year-olds again.
And it never says that he had never been married before either.
No, mm-mm. Doesn't talk about that. But she is referred to as a young woman by the elders in the gate. Let's see, where was it? Oh, 12. Because of the children that the Lord will give you by this young woman. These elders of the gate are sure of it. She had no children in Moab. But they're banking on Boaz or God or somebody.
But no one knows what Boaz means. No meaning for it.
I don't know. I mean, that doesn't mean there's no
Boaz,
meaning.
Yeah, I've got a note that says Boaz probably means in him is strength.
That fits his name for the story. I don't know if I'd want to have a name like that. Imagine naming the kid Boaz. You know what he'd get called in school. Bozo, probably. Did you ever kind
of... Didn't they earn their name?
Well, not always earn them, but certainly they put more significance in what was behind the name than I think we sometimes do.
That's it.
Mm-hmm. Why would...
Go ahead.
Why...
Go ahead.
It was my understanding that you don't name your child Boaz, but or David. He's courage, but that by being courageous, you earn the name.
Are you implying that there was a name change then? Once you had earned it, you maybe would change what the name that was given you at birth.
I thought that the implication was interesting, but it's also my understanding that.
Well, perhaps that did happen at times, although there are children who are named at birth and continue with that name.
These names were so negative. And I can't imagine a parent that couldn't written those names on.
Can you go down to South Africa and listen to the names of these black babies being called? Faithful, Bitter, Sadness? The names of these South African babies and the names of the tragedy they're going through. We have to live through a tragedy to get a name that has a tragic name to it. I think in Southeast Asia, some of the kids' names that I have horrible meanings in their language, mm-hmm. or sad meanings.
Well, I suppose it's possible, too. This is written down long after it has happened, that perhaps the name wasn't quite that. And maybe the narrator did some changing to you know, convey
because
more
the
point.
The name wouldn't really describe the child. It would be a reflection of culture.
The time,
yeah. Okay.
In the same way the prophets gave some of those names to their children, not pitied, and you are no child of mine. And you know, I mean, like if you call your child Auschwitz or Milai or, you know, as commentary on the times in which they were born and then partake of. Yeah, we don't.
Well, the Indians do, don't they?
Yeah. Do they?
Yeah. Well, the children of the 60s, you got Sunshine. I had a kid in my class named Free. You got Moonbeam. You got this from a couple years ago. We've done that too.
Yeah.
Oh, no.
I don't know if it's the boy and the girl, man. This is some part of our family. Sunshine, I think it's the girl.
My little pony.
I think you compare Ruth's actions with any sort of leap in faith. I don't see any faith in the faith of the Lord, not comparable to Abraham.
Well, that's a sad, you know, I get nervous.
Can't you say the same thing about Abraham? He made a decision to leave Haran. The time to get rough in the suburbs, and he decided to try his luck someplace else.
I understand the call from the Lord there.
Yeah, but that can be seen as something that was tacked in later on.
I guess we can tack anything into the Bible and any stories that ain't coming out later on. I just don't see it here. If there's any sort of faith or any calling from God, we can make a decision.
I think you can be faithful to other than just the Lord. You can be faithful to your friends, and maybe they're measuring that comparison in just a measure of faith, not necessarily a measure of faithfulness to the Lord.
Well, I guess there's faith in all kinds of things. It would seem to me that the Bible is written for stories to be talking about faith in the Lord.
Well, she does claim that Naomi's God is her God. Your people.
She doesn't say that before she made this decision. She just says, I'm going to go along with you.
Yeah, but it was, I guess part of that being a leap of faith is that it was not a logical, reasonable decision for her.
Maybe she's crazy.
Maybe she was. And some maybe crazy people responding to the will of God in ways that some of us are blind to. She is forsaking, I believe, you know, she's not going with a sure bet. She would have her chances of remarriage and of survival in that culture were greater if she went to Moab. And instead, she commits herself to a woman who describes herself as death warmed over, practically. And that commitment to another person and in a sense, tossing away your own life. I mean, she is, I mean, if you're just going to look at the odds of her surviving and you know, having a full life, as we might describe it, in Israel, given the hatred of those people, I mean, they despise the Moabites. They despise them. Given that kind of hatred and that cultural that she was willing to go in, and as Ron says, they keep saying, Ruth the Moabitess, you know, that wicked woman who has come, the people, the bastards, the daughter of the bastards who has come to live among us. You know, she knew that. She knew the tradition. And I that was not a safe choice. And somewhere along the line, true, she could have been crazy. If you want to leave it with being crazy and there's no call to God, no leap of faith in that, possibly. But what if she was sane and yet making a crazy decision that goes against the bounds of reason? In that sense, I think we can call it a leap of faith, that she was choosing to commit herself. She's not just going off. She is not a woman who is just independent and crazy. She is choosing to commit herself to her mother-in-law.
Yeah, but faith in what? Based on a faith in what?
You want name or?
And you're saying it's a leap in faith.
Okay.
Faith in what? You know, I have
you want to know?
Abraham had a faith in the Lord, and the Lord calmed. That's how I understand it. And I have, you know, it seems to me we're trying to compare apples and oranges without really.
Maybe
not
only.
Well, we haven't shown that they're both oranges.
Yeah, well, we don't know how articulate it was for the faith of Israel was for her, but we don't know that about Abraham either. I mean, it was real fledgling at that point.
We don't know it about Joseph, for that matter.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a lot of places in the Bible story where the connection to God is veiled, very hidden. It's not up front all the time.
Yeah.
Well, didn't she say, "Where did I go? I will go. Your God, but you'll be my God," so she used the word God, if I remember.
Yeah, she does. But, yeah, I'm sorry.
I think it may be possible to understand how it could be faith if we go back to what you were talking about at the very beginning of the session about being seduced by another's pain so intensely that it's not a matter of what's right or wrong, and you don't worry anymore. Is this right? Am I being faithful? But that she committed herself so much to Naomi that it was indeed a leap of faith. I don't know. Maybe that's not the answer.
I don't know who was first here. For you or Roger?
Ruth had lived with Naomi, and evidently Naomi had translated some of her faith and belief in the Yahweh truth.
Yeah.
She was not ignorant of that.
Yeah, mm-hmm. She knows something. What, we don't know. Roger?
This is probably just a corollary, but why do you think that this story is canonized? Is it all because of Obed and where he fell into the wilderness, or?
Depends on who you read. Some commentators say the point of this story is to give the lineage of David, and so it's dismissed. This particular woman happened to see that there's a lively message of faithful living and risk-taking here, you know, going against some cultural odds.
In 1 Samuel 16, verse 7b, because for the Lord sees not as man sees. Man looks on the outward appearance, the Lord looks on the heart. And I think that a lot of our stories in the faith are God looking at the heart.
But we don't always know why they do what they do.
No.
Yeah.
That's
felt some sense that what Abraham was doing was being faithful to a doctrine, and Ruth wasn't. And I don't think, I guess that I would say myself, I believe that Abraham had no more doctrine to be faithful to than Ruth.
She probably had more, there's more available to her in terms of the faith being articulated at that point than he did, just historically.
After 10 years of living with her mother-in-law and that family, she may have felt more comfortable staying with Naomi than going back to her mother's house.
It's very true. She'd done a lot of her growing up with them, teen years. Well, I have to dismiss you. If you want to stay, you can. 10:02.